Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
Couple of days after MLK Day, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, January 19, 2023. So, this is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. It is Thursday, and I'm back off of the break. So, hopefully, you've come back with me. And if not, you'll catch it further on down the stream and all that good stuff. And we appreciate you. But we'll talk about the new plans, new things coming up in the next couple of days on the network, etc. I got to get to my people here. Mike Swanson in the first hour, WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. But also he's the author of a couple of books that I highly recommend, like The War State and Why the Vietnam War. Both books do I highly recommend indeed. And he's written a bunch of other stuff, too, but you can check him out on Amazon, his author's page. I think I give a link to that with the shows. We'll check. Anyway, in the second hour, the newest version of the Cold War with Larry Hancock, and we'll see what Larry's angle is on it as a sober historian. Is it Cold War 2.0? Is it Cold War 2.0.1? How many versions of this are we going to go through? Well, and how many of them do we need to go through? At the same time, we got plenty of news we could discuss. I mean, after all, a document here, a document there, a document everywhere for, Joe Biden. Right? Is that still a story? The Republicans are, doing what it is that I told you they were gonna do, which is amping up their now let's turn on Biden campaign. And that's what happens when they have a majority in the House. And that's what happens when the Democrats have a majority in the House. And does anything actually change for you? I'm just curious. You listening. Anything change for you when these people change their positions and play musical chairs in the halls of power? Does that happen? By the way, how bad does the economy suck for you? Are there people still wealthy? Sure. We heard about that on Jack Blood's show, although I'm a little disappointed with his viewpoint on how it is you can spray a homeless woman with a hose. But then again, what do you do in San Francisco, right? That was a little odd, and yeah, that was in the news. Plus, well, what else is going on? Murder in, is it Omaha? Omaha, Idaho. Well, one of those places. Anyways, that happening, and what kind of DNA can you leave on a sheath and all that. The news sucks, Mike. But listen, I haven't heard from you in a while, and people didn't hear from me in a while. How you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing good. Of all that stuff you threw out there, there's something. Here's a story. I don't quite understand it. No one really does. That's happening. It's not what I was going to. This has nothing to do with what I mentioned to you before we started the show.
But no problem. We don't have a script, Mike. We can go wherever you want.
But. Yeah, I'm curious if this is happening anywhere else. This is really why I'm going to bring this up. In a neighboring town of where I live, a place got about 30,000 people in it, called Martinsville, Virginia. It's a very depressed town. And it's has the distinction that the county it's in a different county than me, neighboring county, of being the county in the United States that per capita has the most opioids prescribed to people.
Oh, right, right.
The county has a high unemployment rate. I know someone that, well, that's a whole other topic.
Well, you and I, okay, wait a second. You and I talked about this off air, okay? And I don't know where you're going to go with this exactly. I'm not going to predict, but.
Oh, no. The off-air thing is something completely different.
Oh, but, I know. But I'm saying you and I talked about this situation where you're in a neighboring area to one of the highest opioid, prescription.
Yeah.
We talked about because I'm always talking about opioids with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, because it is a thing. And it's crazy what goes on. And yes, there are plenty of areas like this. It's not just, you know, they called it hillbilly heroin for a little while. because it became very prominent in certain very economically depressed areas where people worked, you know, in the kind of jobs where they got injured. A lot of back injuries. Oxycontin took off because there was a demand for it. CNN is apparently releasing yet another one of their documentaries because, you know, that's what they do now. Regarding this, and I think they're calling it America's Pain, and I'm going to have to review it and take a look at it. Because every time these new documentaries are hitting, seems like people are surprised by what's actually happening all around them regarding this. So, yeah, I'd love to hear what your take is, and I don't know where you're going to go, but, man, I don't think there's anywhere in the country where you're not being affected by the opioids, or you haven't been in the past couple of years. This is a, you know, want to talk about something that's endemic, that's epidemic, that is, you know, again, endemic to the circumstance of living in America at this particular time. Opioids are inescapable. And of course, there's plenty of get ready and be terrified over fentanyl. There's that happening. I saw one last night that was really insane regarding this whole, you know, one pill kills. Have you seen that yet, the one pill kills campaign?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, well, they got a whole advertising campaign about how one pill of fentanyl can kill you, and okay. There's parents that are coming out going, you know, my kid only did one pill and they died. And I got to tell you, I got a hard time believing that, because generally speaking, you know, if somebody got a hold of that kind of thing. Anyway.
I mean, it could be, you know, any pill, it doesn't have to be fentanyl, but any medicine that you put in your body, you know, it could kill you.
Yeah.
I heard a story of someone dying from eating shrimp, you know, that for they have an allergic reaction to shrimp. But the thing is, what's happened with the unusual, you know, the opioids aren't unusual. What's unusual is they've had this story in this town. Mm-hmm. Where they're saying that homeless people mm-hmm. are being bussed into the town and just dropped off. And it was first reported that some of them came from where I live, that someone took the people, I live like 20 miles away.
Right.
Some people took homeless people in the place I live and put them on a bus and dropped them off in this Martinsville place, and supposedly they're being dropped off from other cities.
Yeah.
And just dumped there. Now, I've never heard of anything like that, and I was listening to some local news in that town.
Yep.
And they were saying that someone on their city council was on this news show and
you,
said
wait,
that
wait a second. You really never heard of that before, Mike? Seriously, you never heard of the people taking their homeless problem and pretty much moving it to another town? You've never heard of that kind of thing being done elsewhere?
No.
No?
Not,
okay, okay.
Not
well,
around here.
Look, I'm not judging you.
They were saying.
Well, have you ever heard of it? Wait a second. Have you ever heard of it somewhere else? Because
Not really.
I'm not judging you on this. I'm asking this question.
No, honestly. I've never heard of this.
Okay, you never heard of it. Okay, let me tell you something. This has happened for at least 20 years. Okay, and if you don't believe me, you could see that it was parodied on an episode of South Park some years ago, where they had this thing where the homeless people they treated it like a zombie apocalypse because it's a joke, you know. And it was like, how did all these homeless people start to appear in South Park? It turns out that they were sent from another town. The reason why South Park was parodying this is because although it did not become, you know, big corporate news headlines, this kind of thing was happening all over the country. In certain places where they got kind of overwhelmed with their homeless problem, they were turning around and sending people from, say, like L.A., to, you know, some other town that might be a working class town and kind of bleeding off their homeless population, encouraging them, offering them free bus tickets, telling them that, you know what, all of our services here are overwhelmed, but if you go over to the next county, they have services for you. They did this in New Jersey. they sent people, the Ocean County, social services department was so overwhelmed because of a serious surge in homelessness around the real estate collapse in 08 and 09, right? There was a surge in homelessness in Ocean County. They sent them to Atlanta County. They sent some of them to Monmouth County, okay, which are two adjoining counties. They literally had people, and they weren't directly like working for the government, so you couldn't go to City Hall to go get it, but they hired these organizations that would come around and try and help them, and under the guise of, there are services available in this other town, there are services available in this other county. It's the same trick that they're playing with the illegal migrants coming over the border in Mexico, where it's like, well, let's just send them to their sanctuary city. We'll stick it to them. It's the same methodology, and this is the thing that kills me, is that nobody recognizes this. They were shuffling the homeless over to another place. Now, that changes your demographics. Now, you don't have the same homeless count and population, right? If you can figure out a way to bus 100 people out of your town or your city, then you have now reduced your homeless population by 100, right? So, yeah, there were private organizations, seemingly private organizations, that came in under the guise of assisting them with navigating social services and stuff, okay? It's the same kind of people that they dispatch out there to give out the Obama phones. Where have you seen that phenomenon, Mike? Or, you know, maybe you're not in a poor enough area.
Well, I've heard of that.
Okay, well, there are people that will stand out there all day long. They set up a card table in front of, you know, some store that's fairly got a decent amount of foot traffic, and they'll put up a sign that says, we have free phones for you, and they have free tablets. And it's just, if you can sign up. So it's like the, you know, sign up because you're already on some government assistance. Well, through those lists, they turn around and buy those lists from those, from that, you know, that secondary agency that does that work. They buy those lists and then they call you up. Hey, do you want help finding food pantries? Hey, do you want help finding new services? And there are people that are legitimately trying to say, look, take advantage of all the things that you can because you're in a bad spot, you're poor, whatever. And, they'll do things like distribute, text messages about all the food pantries. Right? And the food banks in the area. So you can go, on a Thursday and you can get a box of food for your family, whatever. Well, they buy those mailing lists, and in some cases, they end up with homeless people, and they start saying, you know what? Over to the next county, it's a richer county. Or over to this other city, it's richer. It's got more, stuff available that people aren't using. There's room in their shelters. There's free food. There's, you know, a place where you can eat dinner every night for free, stuff like that. And they'll just, like I say, pawn off their problem locally onto another locality. And that's been going on at the very least 20 years that I can observe, maybe longer. But I saw it in Jersey. I saw it in North Carolina. I've seen it here, where they will literally push people along. And we had a homeless problem here in Macon, Georgia, where people were sleeping under the bridges. And there were complaints to the mayor and all that stuff, and he moved people out of that position where they were, you know, in plain sight sleeping under the bridges. And at a certain point, part of that population just seemed to clear up. All right? And what I hear is that a bunch of them showed up a couple of towns over where they don't have as high a population, but they had more funding available, more stuff locally for them to be able to utilize. And that's it. You just dispatch one of these, you know, middleman helper organizations, and instead of them handing out Obama phones or telling them, you know, exactly where they can go to sign up for food stamps or where you can go to sign up for job placement or whatever, they just say, hey, listen, you know what? We can actually get you a bus ticket, and you can go to a place that has more funding. Now, whether it's true or not is another story, but what they successfully do, especially if an election year is coming up for the town council, for the mayor and all that, they can make an honest claim that, hey, during my time in office, reelect me because I have now decreased the population. I'm really shocked that you've never heard of this because to me, it's like common knowledge.
One of the components of what they're talking about, this is what I really haven't heard of, is they're saying there's money made off of this, that there's organizations that get money for helping homeless people or or people, or not necessarily homeless, they don't have to be homeless, for counseling and providing services to people. And so what they were claiming is that these type of organizations, I think it was some sort of organization that's helping people get off drugs or something like that, that they are getting these people to come in order to make a little bit of money off of that. And then the people might be thinking that they're going to get more help than they're going to get, you know. And then they get passed around from one of these groups to another one of these groups.
Right. Right. Well, but
so there's a private component to it, not just, you know, at least this story. You know, it's not simply the local government's doing it, what these people are saying, but it's some private.
But that's what I'm saying, is that a middleman gets created to facilitate this stuff.
Money somehow from this.
Well, the middleman can be non-profit, but a non-profit doesn't mean that nobody gets a paycheck, you see. So you got guys who are getting a good paycheck.
Yeah, you got directors of these and people in these non-profits.
Well, right, so they have to be paid to direct the organization, and they hire people because they, you know, like I said, those people that get, you know, sit there at those card tables, they get paid something. And it's not a tough job to sit there and sign up people, right, for Obama phones or whatever. These middleman organizations get sort of dispatched, you know, deployed, if you will, to achieve these things. Now, I'm not saying that, like I said, the towns aren't paying for it. The middleman organization is taking care of it, and it's being funded by this system that is in place to facilitate helping people, right? You know what I'm saying? Like the nonprofit, you know, shelters and stuff like that, where it's like, yeah, that's literally a facility that's right on the ground helping people. But if you have their social workers and stuff, you know, listen, if you send people to my organization, I'll help them out. Social workers are constantly looking for, well, can I get jobs for these people? Can I get housing for these people? Et cetera, right? So these other organizations come in and they're being funded by people that, say, want to support the political candidate, not the candidate themselves, but now that candidate can make a claim. I have actually cleared up some of the homeless because there's less here than there was last year, etc. But all they've really done is push them down the road, you see. And like you said, they sometimes send them under deceptive pretense and tell them, you know, there's stuff over here, and they go to that new place and there is no help there. But they sent them there under that, you know, idea. Remember that those lawsuits started getting filed over the people being sent to Martha's Vineyard, right? Remember that story where they, well, but it's the same technique. I'm like really amazed that people didn't know that this is just a refitting, a retrofitting of something that's been going on. So I don't get it. Anyway, like I said, Mike, it's just, it's very weird to me that this is even new to some people, but go ahead and tell me about the particular circumstances near you, because I think
I really don't know anything beyond what I'm saying. They're not saying any details. They're just saying they're investigating it. And what I'm, you know, I was watching a city council person in this Martinsville place talk about it, and you know, they're real, really vague about it beyond what I'm just saying. You can't really figure it out.
Well, no, but I mean, what do you think of what it is I'm explaining to you? That this is just something that goes on. If you go and you dig for it, I guarantee you'll find it near you, where they've done something with another, you know, a supposedly nonprofit or charitable organization comes in with some kind of name. You know, they're there to promote, you know, equality.
Well, what
and,
you're describing sounds like this sort of situation, you know.
Yeah, well, but that's what I'm saying, is it's the same methodology. It may be slightly different in your area. That's why I was saying, you know, go ahead and tell us about it. But I'm just saying, this is nothing new, where you just sort of push, you know, it's just like when they gentrify a place and they turn around and say, well, you know, now we have greater tax revenue. Yeah, because you moved all the poor people out and refitted the place, and therefore you have a higher rental situation. So, you know, the property value goes up. You can charge a higher property tax, and all of a sudden, you know, the town's treasury is flush with cash, right? I mean, it's a very simple shuffle that gets done, and what happens is, really, there eventually, you run out of, you know, musical chairs to play with poor people, with people that are, you know, as Jack pointed out, you're not supposed to say homeless anymore, the unhoused, the poor people, the people that don't even realize that they're below the poverty line at all. Because, you know, the average income in the United States, right? I always love that figure, don't you, Mike? The average income in the United States. How do we get that average? You know, what is it, $120,000 or $150,000? I don't know anybody who makes that.
No, that's not the average income of people.
Yeah, but you ever read that statistic where they go, well, the medium income in America is this. So how many people got to be millionaires versus the people that are making, you know, $20,000 a year then? I mean, I just wonder, because that's a hell of a jump to move from, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, and I've already priced out most of my listeners from existence at 50,000. And long ago did I price myself out of existence. The point is, you get to $50,000, you're still, you know, a family of three, say. You're still not able to make it. In most places. I was looking at places where I used to live even recently, because I've been like homesick for New Jersey, right? And,
if it's, you know, the average, I mean, not average, I don't want to use the word average, but in Virginia, they've raised the state minimum wage up. And so in the city I'm living in, this is one of the things going on. The firefighters have been complaining. The county's got volunteer firefighters, but the city,
right,
is separate. They're professional, paid by the city, and they have complained that they're being paid less than the firefighters in neighboring cities. A lot less. For example, they're showing that in some cities they're getting paid as a starting salary $40,000.
Okay.
And they're making $31,000 here. So they're saying that firefighters are leaving to go work in these other places. They can't get anyone to come here now.
Right.
And they've asked the city to rectify the situation for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a year ago they said they would do a study. And then the study said they need to raise, you know, that, yeah, there is a wage discrepancy. And then they didn't do anything about it. And then the issue became public around New Year's, and now they're saying they're going to do another study that'll be completed by June, July, that won't just study the firefighters. The city manager, the city council is saying they're going to study all city employees,
mm-hmm,
not just the firefighters. Well, the firefighters are still upset because they're not getting what they deserve, but out of this, they gave them a very small raise,
right,
to match their current salary with the increase in the state minimum wage.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, no one's said this, and this is my speculation when I say this, but it's interesting that they're delaying doing anything until the second half of the year. Because in the second half of the year, this Caesars is going to open up a temporary casino and has to kick back, you know, something like $5 million, at least $5 million in revenue,
okay,
to the city. So they'll have enough money to pay, you know, all these people raises by then. So coincidence or not,
mm-hmm,
but at the same time, this is one of the problems with, I see with cities everywhere, they're spending, you know, they're spending lots of money. There's an old giant textile plant that has been sitting there empty, rotting away mm-hmm. for like 20 years now.
Right.
I go by it and just think they should just, someone should just tear it to the ground, you know, but the cities partner up with some real estate development company to renovate this thing.
Right.
It'll be 350,000 square feet, and it's going to cost like $85 million. Right. And the city is spending at least several million on helping to renovate it and do things around it. It's on a river. They're going to, we want to tear down a dam that's on the river, renovate these bridges.
Okay.
Do all, you know, at least $5 million and all this stuff, you know. And this is cities all across the United States. You ever been to Baltimore?
Yeah, I have. I'll just go locally. They did a whole renovation and they're working on it right now. This whole, like, entertainment center where we're going to have, like, a new amphitheater and new malls and things are going to be
these things.
These
projects. Were you ever been to the Inner Harbor in Baltimore?
I don't think I ever went to the harbor. No.
Okay. Well, that was one of the big. Okay, in Baltimore, I'd explain it with this story. In Baltimore, mm-hmm. you know, Baltimore's got it's called nowadays. It's got two nicknames. I think, what is the violent nickname? Bombing Moore or something?
Okay.
It's not bombing. But anyway, it's got a negative nickname associated with crime. And then they call it Charm City.
Mm.
Now, that in the 70s, the city hired a woman to figure out a way to rent. You know, they wanted to change the city.
Right.
Industrial decay and the steel industry all collapsing and the place was decaying, you know, a lot of crime. And they wanted to reinvent the city. So they needed a new slogan and this woman came up with Charm City and the idea was to try to attract visitors, tourists to the city based on the differences and attractions, I guess, of different ethnic neighborhoods in Baltimore. And mm-hmm. So it's charming, you know, Italians, Greeks.
Oh, yeah, this is where they come in with,
you know,
the ethnic,
all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the ethnic diversity,
you know.
And they do the celebration. It's like the new...
parades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did this to Asbury Park, by the way.
Huh?
They did this to Asbury Park a couple of years ago. I was totally shocked.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And it worked. I mean, they had parades and events and stuff. And the idea, part of the idea is if you do these sort of events, mm-hmm. that would help the crime go down and it'll bring people into the city spending money mm-hmm. and so forth. Well, along with this, in around 1980, they did the Inner Harbor renovations, which hundreds of millions, you know, in today's money, it'd be hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
And it was a dump, you know, but what they, you know, they created this big shopping area. There's a science center. There's an aquarium there, shopping areas and so mm-hmm. forth. And it's at the harbor, obviously. Across the street from it is another fancy shopping center that's, a big, these fancy shopping areas. Now, I remember going, we lived when I was a child like 30 miles away from there, and I remember going to this, we lived outside the city, mm-hmm. 30 miles outside the city. I remember going to this stuff a couple times, mm-hmm. and it would be real crowded and stuff. I mean, this is in the early 80s.
Oh, by the way, it just occurred to me that Baltimore was, two of the nicknames that traveled around that were very negative was Bodymore and Bulletmore. by the way.
Bodymore. That's the one I'm trying to remember. Yeah. Bodymore. Yeah. Right. Well, the thing about it, Chuck, I mean, this was the showcase, this Inner Harbor, and it's in a, now those shopping areas are abandoned.
Yeah.
They're abandoned. That, yeah, I didn't, I went, you know, I went to, I took my mom down there like 2 years ago, and last year we didn't go in the shopping area. We just walked by it. The year before we went in there, and it seemed kind of abandoned, not the year before, 2019, mm-hmm. but like malls across America, you know, I think COVID just, that was the end of it.
See,
and the one across the street from it's abandoned. But what I want to try to tell you, the point of all this is that cities all in across America, and they're doing it here with this white mill project, they invest all this money in doing these real estate development things, and the real estate properties, they're privately owned. So the business people that are involved in these deals, they make a lot of money from it with the assistance of the taxpayer.
But that's what happens every time. Look, Mike, I want to go to a break real quick, but before we do that, here's the thing. These booms and busts come in cities and areas of interest all the time, okay? Where they come in, they gentrify, they revitalize, whatever it is they describe it as. Private money comes in, it builds it up, they always get sweetheart deals, whether it's for a stadium or it's for a diverse shopping area or whatever, and it generates revenue for a little while. It's the same argument they use to build, you know, those malls we grew up with as kids. That stuff was built in the 60s and 70s, right? As a way to create shopping centers for the suburban, you know, customers that were all coming out of the cities, that were moving to the burbs, right? The different white flight areas, the different, you know, okay, I'd rather commute to my job than be living in the city kind of situation. And they had to build these malls in all of these suburbs that were satellites of different cities. Then they failed after a while. All of these revitalizations, eventually, they boom, they come up. Yes, people make a lot of money. There are jobs, even if they're crap jobs, where you're working at the pretzel stand or you're selling hot dogs at the stadium, whatever. They come, they go for a while, and then they go bust. Okay? It's just the way of things. The only thing that has a bit of longevity sometimes is a business like a major sports team. But other than that, these other, you know, these other revitalizations, they have come and gone. And they used to do it, they did it before you and I were born. Okay, you and I are similar age. And they did it when we were kids, and they collapsed, and then they were rebuilt again in the 90s when credit was, you know, flowing. They have collapsed again. COVID, you know, gave the death knell to a lot of things, but before COVID, I was seeing the abandoned malls and all that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, that the day of the mall, the day of the, you know, mall shopping and the overpriced goods that could be there because you could go to one place and they had, you know, the clothing store, the record store, the da-da-da-da. All of that stuff has gone bust, some of it because of the online business, but also just because this is the nature of it, I think. The boom and bust cycle of the retail establishment, the shopping center, the restaurant district, all of these things, they get revitalized and they go away. They get revitalized and they go away. Sometimes they build it around universities, you know, again, sports program involved. Sometimes they build it around teams. We bring in a hockey team. We bring in a football team. We bring in a baseball team. They build it around that. And eventually, it doesn't work anymore because everything goes boom and bust. That's the way I see it. I don't know if you see it the same way, and maybe you're witnessing, you know, one in real time right in your neighborhood. But I got to tell you, I've seen this repeat itself throughout my lifetime. Maybe I'm wrong. What do you think about that?
No, that's what's happening, and I'm witnessing the boom start, or
And hey, look,
but,
it'll be nice.
The thing about it, though, in all of these cities, is that this is presented as the solution to the urban problem.
Yeah.
And in the end, not much really changes for the people already living in these places.
Yeah, right. Eventually, to be honest with you, the snake always eats itself. It's just that simple. Mike Swanson is with me. WallStreetWindow.com is his website. We're talking about urban blight, revitalization, and gentrification, believe it or not. But who knows what we'll discuss in the next segment. And in the second hour, Larry Hancock will be with us. So stick around. The Ocelli Effect will continue after this.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Ocelli.com. Support Chuck Ocelli at Ocelli.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly.
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this too, because, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapon. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
The second segment of the Thursday night Ocelli Effect here. Mike Swanson is with me, and you are wherever you are. So, and you are whenever you are, because most of you do listen to this via the podcast. Anyways, Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War. You know, I'm sorry to do it to you, but I got to ask you about some things. And let's go with it. Because, you know, Elon Musk was a huge deal there. In the news for a bit, wasn't he? I mean, I know we got the Prince to cover, right? What's going on with him? I guess people care about that, right? Prince Harry? Yeah? No? Okay. The same crickets that I just heard there are exactly what I hear in my head when people want to, what do you think about the Prince? I don't. I just don't. I don't care. He's very upset because they were mean to his wife. All right. I gotta say that I did like the fact that he, well, first of all, served in the military and then, you know, discussed it in an honorable way and actually has a goal of trying to help other veterans. I'll give him that. But outside of that, I got no use for this guy. Why do we care? We're in America. This is not our royalty. Okay? Right. Anyway, look, speaking of our royalty, though, right, the geniuses that are. Elon Musk, you know, wasn't he in, like, every headline every single day because of Twitter? How is Tesla doing? Oh, that's right. We're not supposed to talk about that. I mean, is he going to lose money on Twitter, Mike? I mean, what do you think? Well, that doesn't have much to do with the stock market, but it does have something to do with social media. But then again, what the hell is going on? I mean, the economy still sucks. I mentioned that in my opening. The economy still sucks. I know if you're, you know, out there living and you're not well healed, you know it too. I mean, Mike, you go to the grocery store, you know the economy sucks. I mean, I saw a meme on Facebook, this week. I have a dozen eggs. I'm willing to trade it for a truck.
Whoa. I stopped somewhere to get some food, and I was sitting down, and they had the news on at 5:30. And I was by myself, and they were doing a segment on eggs and people buying chickens instead of eggs now. And the CDC issuing a stark warning on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stayed an extra minute to watch that television segment, and they basically said that you can get salmonella and all these diseases from chickens. And really trying to scare people from even thinking about.
Well,
my grandmother had chickens.
No, look, and that's the thing. It's smart.
She didn't die from it.
Look, it's smart to have chickens at this point because the price of eggs is ridiculous, right? And what's funny is that we've just gone through this whole thing where they said, well, gee, why is it that we jacked up chicken to the exorbitant price level it's at, right? Chicken is now brutally expensive. I can't afford to buy chicken. I can't afford to buy beef.
Well, they are supposedly.
Well, they had
right after actually.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
This segment.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Right after this segment, they had a story coming up that across the border, North Carolina, supposedly, well, it's what they're reporting. There's chickens and turkeys. Being farmed, and they are destroying 20,000 of them because they caught a disease.
Well, they've been destroying them because, look,
yeah, they're doing it.
What was the justification for why it is that your Thanksgiving turkey was massively expensive, right? If you tried to buy a turkey for Thanksgiving, what did they tell us? Because of the outbreak of bird flu, a whole lot of the population normally that is being used for that had to be culled. Now, Mike, you know very well that the turkeys generally that most of people receive, right, are frozen, and they've been frozen for a while. I mean, I know some people can afford a fresh turkey, but I couldn't afford fresh turkeys before this economic crunch, right? Thing is, though, if you could afford a fresh turkey, God bless you, what can I tell you? But most of us would get these things that were rock hard and were frozen the year before. So, if you just unpack it logically, the bird population, which needed to be destroyed because of the avian flu, is from last year already. So what was affecting you at Thanksgiving and what has jacked up your chicken price now and has jacked up your egg price is exactly the same thing that's now been going on, not for the past couple of months, not because they're getting ready to destroy chickens and turkeys and whatever else, but because it's been going on. So is it avian flu?
Chickens and turkeys are the new oil.
Well, there you go. And like I said, I saw this thing on Facebook. I'll trade you a dozen eggs and I think I want a pickup truck, and don't try to lowball me. I know what I got. Because have you tried to buy eggs lately, Mike? Do you eat eggs?
Yeah, I eat eggs.
Okay. So have you tried to buy eggs lately?
I bought some Saturday for the first time in a month, and there wasn't many for sale.
Wasn't many for sale, so, and they were how much? $5-6? For a dozen?
It might have been seven.
Seven, okay.
But, for a dozen. It was a lot. Well, I know that I'm spending like twice as much on groceries than what I was a year ago.
Easily. If you're buying the same food, you're easily... This is why I don't understand this whole 18%, because I figure people got to eat. And if they're buying groceries, your grocery bill didn't go up no 18%. Okay? Your housing bill didn't go up 18%. If you pay rent and you had an adjustable time period in the past year and a half, guaranteed it went up, and guaranteed it went up significantly. Okay.
Actually, I read a story around Thanksgiving that it was saying that it was cheaper for families to go out to dinner than it was to cook the Thanksgiving dinner themselves.
Yeah, right. So that was weird. And as soon as the restaurant industry gets a hold of that, what happens? They raise their price. I mean, think about this. Have you gotten a pizza lately, Mike? Talk about something that's normal takeout food, typical standard, all across the country, pizza. Have you tried to buy a pizza lately?
Not in a month.
Not in a month. Okay. Well,
I haven't noticed any. I mean, if it's changed in the past month, I don't know.
But do you know what maybe the price...
But it was going up higher before then.
Right. Okay, so a month ago, you knew what the price was. Now, a year before that, was the price lower or not?
Oh, it was lower.
I mean, these are unscripted questions, folks. Mike does not know what I'm going to ask him, has no idea why I'm asking him.
There was an interesting moment in the spring last year, because I like to eat a pizza like once a month, and I was somewhere at a restaurant where you can get, that's what their main dish is. Uh-huh. And at that, because the prices for stuff was changing, I wasn't sure if I was buying the pizza for a good price or not.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be a good price. It was only
$12. Oh, $12? Yeah, that's cheap, man. You kidding me?
For just a pepperoni pizza. Yeah. But I wasn't, it was a good price. Now that place is probably 16 or something.
Yeah, see, now 3 years ago only, right? Your price point on a very good, something that somebody used good ingredients was $10, right?
Yeah, that would be $10. Yeah.
And nowadays, if you go to that same place that uses, the high-end ingredients, you're talking about, I saw a pizza price for $18.50. One topping.
Yeah. That's...
That's a gourmet pizza now. Okay? So, I mean, just think about that percentage of increase. I'm just trying to say. Look, and even if you look at the crap cookie cutter stuff that they put out, right? Your Domino's, your Little Caesars, your Walmart pizza, the one that you buy at Walmart and you bring home to heat up yourself, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Or you buy one at a grocery store. Those pizzas have now outpriced what you would have paid for a place that actually cooks it and makes it for you by hand in front of you. Okay. As opposed to last year where I am. The Walmart pizza cost me more than the hand-tossed pizza that I could have bought a year ago. Now, I'm not buying many pizzas, okay? I don't have the money for it. And I don't have the money to buy the stuff to make it at home either. I'm having to make adjustments on my diet here because there's just monetary concerns, okay?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are doing that. Now, I don't know about takeout or, you know, going to a restaurant and sitting down and eating. I haven't done that in a very long time. But, you know, maybe when we go to Dallas, I'll actually sit down in a restaurant, you know, with you somewhere. We might go to the Witch Witch again or something. I don't know. But either way, you know, and I'm hoping to be, I'm going to make it to Dallas somehow. Hopefully my co-host B. Pete gives me the ride there that he promised me. Because I don't know if I can afford the tickets to get there. I have no idea what a bus ticket is now. And, again, riding Greyhound is, you know, I imagine that if you go to hell when you die, that you have to go Greyhound. I really think so. Just saying, and I'm not making any spiritual judgments. I'm just saying, I think if they send you to hell, you must go on a packed Greyhound bus. It just makes sense. Anyway, sorry, Mike. I have digressed, so to speak. But the point is, we're all being squeezed. Elon Musk was big time in the news, like I was saying, you know, about his people are going, oh, is he going to make money on his $1 billion? But Tesla's fallen, right? And what is the market doing at this point? Because everybody was talking about the interest rates and all that stuff, and now we're, you know, lost in the sauce regarding how many documents does Joe Biden have in an office where he hasn't been in 2 years, and, you know, who's cooperating, who's not, and who's mishandling classified documents. I'll give you guys a special sneak spoiler here. They all are. But, okay. It's just the way of things. But, I mean, honestly, the economic news. What can we observe? I mean, what are we looking forward to? Are we about to, you know, finally admit that we're in a recession? I mean, what is happening, Mike? Can you give us a snapshot?
It's stagflationary economy.
Okay.
That's what's happening.
See, Mike's laughing
it's
at
like
me.
The 1970s.
Wait, why are you laughing when I asked that question?
Huh?
Why were you, like, laughing when I asked that question? Like, is he serious? I mean, did you, like, go, is he really serious after that rant? He's going to ask me how the economy is. What was that about?
It's the simple explanation. We were told inflation was transitory and all.
Right.
Temporary. They said at first it was because of COVID disruptions. Then right. They blamed it all last year on the war in Ukraine.
Sure, why not?
And now what's yeah. No, I'm just telling you what's going to happen now.
Go ahead.
They're going to declare that it's gone away because the way they measure it, they'll talk about the CPI number.
Oh, God.
Consumer.
All right.
Well, but this is the trick. When they talk about the CPI number, they'll talk about annualized CPI. So they'll end up comparing what happens this month or next month to what happened during those months a year ago. And a year ago, from January to June, is when inflation was going up at the fastest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rate of the increase slowed down. So they're going to be comparing now to the, you know, hottest inflationary months of last year.
Right.
You know, over the next several months. So they're going to be able to report that it's not, you know, that it's improving, because they're going to be comparing it to what happened last year.
So what you're telling me is, effectively, and correct me if I'm wrong.
That doesn't mean the prices are going to go down. They're not.
Okay. So what you're telling me, just correct me if I'm wrong, is that we are about to re-enter a time when you and I were on this show, and I would tell you, look, they keep giving me headlines in the economic news about economic recovery. And you'd go, yeah, that's what they say. And I'd go, yeah, where is it? Is that where we're about to go back to, the Obama era economy where everything's recovering, but it just, if you're on the ground in reality, in the real world, you can't even manage to play with the numbers enough to make that make sense. And yet they're going to keep saying, cause I'm already seeing that they're saying that, the inflation is cooling down, right? That's one of their terms now, cooling down. I keep hearing it's cooling down. The inflation was hot. Now it's cooling down. Are we about to go back into that time period, Mike, where I'm going to keep asking you where the economic recovery is? Is that where we're going?
Well, I don't know if they'll be bold enough to say it's a big boom or anything like that. They're just going to be saying it's not as bad. You know, the inflation's improving. Yeah, but I don't.
I'm sorry. Look, you know what? You and I are trying to laugh because it reminds me of that line in Detroit Rock City where, you know, I got to laugh because I know I'm going to die. I mean, you got to laugh at the circumstance when, you know, you know you're being crushed. You know everybody you know is being crushed. You know that the system is absolutely loaded and rigged to make sure that there is no possibility that you can get ahead. And yet they're going to keep telling you, look, it's getting better. And there are going to be certain people out there that on faith alone, if the right person, if the right side of the equation, if their favorite TV personality and their favorite politician agree, they're going to say, you know what, things are getting better, even though the reality is not changing. And it's just a matter of not are you getting squeezed or are you not getting squeezed. It's just a matter of how hard and how fast. And, you know, you can replace the word squeezed with something else that begins with an F if you'd like to, but I don't like to curse on my show. So, I mean, that's where we're going, it seems like, Mike. I mean, I know that that's a hell of a down note to end on, but am I right or wrong?
Well, I mean, I think generally that's what's happening.
That's what's happening. Well, look, you and I will find more interesting things to talk about, I assure you, in the coming weeks. Are you going to be with us next week?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Excellent. I promise you, Mike, we'll find better things to talk about other than gentrification. And are you ready for recession, depression? I promise you, I'm gonna go out of my way to find more entertaining and informative subjects that are not just absolutely terrible. And okay, is that a fair deal?
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
Okay. So, Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. If you can afford to buy one of his books, please do. Support Mike. He supports the show. I appreciate him, and he puts up with me. So, you know, what are you going to do? Mike, anything you want to say on your way out the door before I get to Larry Hancock?
No, I'm real interested to see what Larry has to say tonight.
Listen, so am I. And, look, I really appreciate your time. Thank you. Mike Swanson, once again, everybody, WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street at all because, you know, if you want to just follow Wall Street, look, you're going to be depressed. And if all you do is follow money, you're going to be depressed. And, gee, that's a hint. That's a hint. Maybe money is not the solution for everything. Although I could use some solutions. So donate to the network. Support us. All right. Mike, thanks so much. And we'll talk to you next week, okay?
Thank you. We'll talk to you then.
Right. Larry Hancock coming up, the author extraordinaire, who I appreciate, in the next segment on the Ocelli Effect. Stick around.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks, Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Mary Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Mary Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War, by author Mike Swanson.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Ochelli.com.
Ah, third and final segment of the Ochelli Effect tonight, looks like. We shall see. Had a little technical glitch there, joining into my intro on the hour. It's okay. Hopefully we got all of them out of the way, because I have author Larry Hancock with me. Of course, Larry, if you don't know, occupies more slots on my bookshelf than any other author, and for a good reason. The behavior of the national security state through various volumes that have focused on everything from the JFK assassination to, let me see if I got my terms right, UAPs, right? Yes, right. Unidentified.
That would be it.
Yeah. Unidentified aerial phenomena, which I thought was really interesting, in a book called Unidentified. But tonight we might be focusing on not the JFK assassination, not the RFK assassination, not the MLK assassination. No, not a political assassination necessarily. But there might be political assassinations along the way in the discussion. Why? Cold War 2.0. Now, does this involve Larry's book, Creating Chaos? It just might. But we've done a bunch of shows, actually, that somehow we had to reference your book, Creating Chaos, didn't we, Larry? And with good reason. Okay. The Cold War 2.0 concept. Let me just say a couple of things before I basically hand it over to the much more learned individual on the line here, who I admire his work, okay? Look, bottom line is that what we have been dealing with for the past couple of years is a very interesting paradigm shift in my mind. We went from Russia being the enemy and people complaining that, well, you know, people are just trying to create a false boogeyman out of Russia based on the old Cold War era idea, and therefore trying to reboot the Cold War concept. Why? Because this will generate interest in business for the always needy military-industrial complex. Okay, that's a wonderful oversimplified way to look at it. Fair enough, but the paradigm shift started to happen some years back in my mind when there were people who were so dissatisfied with Barack Obama's presidency and his administration regime, what have you, that there was a hero status sort of granted to this guy, Vladimir Putin. Look, he's a manly man. He's a guy in control of his country. He's now a good guy. We shouldn't identify him along with his history, which he is connected to, regarding what? The KGB, the Soviet Union. I mean, Vladimir Putin was alive, indeed, had been a mayor in you know, a Russian city, a major one. He had been a serious player in the intelligence agencies, as far as I can tell. So he was connected to that past, but he's not that past. And now he's a much more preferable leader to the weak sister, if you will, of Barack Obama. Okay, so I saw that happen, and I saw the propaganda game being played by Russia Today, the English-speaking version of Russian state media, which, you know, became something big and reliable and good in alt media and all that kind of good stuff. I watched this flourish and happen. Then we have the interesting interplay and the games that have been played by both the D's and the R's there regarding a place called Ukraine. Today we have an active war, which I cannot fathom how it has continued to be an occurrence in Ukraine, Larry. But it has. I want a sober view on this concept of, is it just, you know, somebody wants to sell us Cold War 2.0, 2.01, 2.01A? I don't know. Trying to revamp that? Do we need the new boogeyman? Is that what the whole game is? Is this just a propaganda warfare event? Is this just spheres of influence struggling with one another? And we do need a new enemy? Is that what needs to be? Because the war on terror, I don't think, is selling so well anymore. What is actually happening? And what can we know about what is actually happening truly? Because there is the public face of everything, and then there is always the undercurrent, which is driven by a whole lot of interests, some of them political, some of them corporate, some of them interlocking.
It is to kind of step back and and ask yourself, what's normal and what's not? When do normal international relations kind of go over and become something special? You know, something that you should be concerned about. Something, and I think in creating chaos, I kind of lay out a tier of activities that describe relations between any entity that considers itself to be like a major geopolitical player. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it was an empire, a kingdom, you know, earlier, you know, we had empires like the British Empire, German Empire, Russian Empire that played games with each other, you know, for centuries. Now we have nation states that do those same things. So this is nothing new. The question is, what stages does it go through, and how can you tell when it's getting more serious and it's passed from one stage to the other? And I think what we have to accept is that all of these entities who are, you know, battling for spheres of influence, economic influence, political influence, they consider themselves adversaries at one level. Actually, even those who are allies sometimes are adversarial in certain situations. But, you know, that's kind of the norm. You expect that. You expect, you know, them to be carrying out activities which you would call shaping, you know, trying to create a good image for themselves, trying to establish economic alliances, you know, which give them leverage, you know. So all of that is routine. You expect that. And it strikes me, it's sort of like it is not really accurate to say, oh, you know, we did something special to them because we were trying to establish economic relationship or military alliances. That's not something special. Everybody does that. All kingdoms, empires, nation states have always done that with allies and adversaries. So if somebody comes forth to me and says, oh, well, you know, the CIA was involved in Eastern Europe, yeah, the KGB was involved in Eastern Europe. It's that's kind of business as usual. So to answer your question, I don't think we should confuse normal geopolitical adversarial relationships. That's what happens. You don't get too excited about them.
Right.
When they go to what are called active measures, and when that starts to involve, extensive intelligence collections, penetrations of establishing leverage over your adversaries, political figures, economic figures, when you start lining up people to deliver your propaganda for you, so that it's coming from within, and especially when you start to move into covert actions, where it involves sabotage, theft of data, quite frankly, even sometimes assassinations and blackmail. Mm-hmm. When it goes from just, shaping their view of you to you're actually engaging in what are called active measures, that's where you start entering into the Cold War territory. Does that make sense?
It does, and it leads to a very direct and simple sort of question where I find a lot of people who discuss this convolute different eras together and misunderstand this exactly as you just explained how you gotta take a look at the difference between active measures and the normal interchanges, the normal interactions of competitor and cooperative relationships, between nation states. I mean, that's very simple, but there are different eras here, and of course we focus on the U.S. versus Russia now, right? The Russian Federation. But we do have to recognize that there was definitely a difference in behavior between the, pre-collapsing Soviet Union and then the time of economic and other opportunism that took place when it was collapsing, right? And people bring up the whole reorganization of NATO, and NATO encircles Russia, and therefore this is the reason for blah, blah, blah. All of that comes into play. And then there's an era that exists now, which I think is also different from, say, the time when Clinton was in office and doing that stuff, and the time when there was opportunism that took hold just in the private corporate world, where people took advantage of the circumstance because of the economic collapse of the Soviet Union, not necessarily the military side of it and all of that. But all of these things, I think, get sort of convoluted together, and people try to oversimplify this sort of relationship that we have versus the one that we had before all of those things I just listed. So how do we parse that out?
I think we can actually parse it out and put some dates to it. Mm-hmm. That are helpful. And add some balance. One of the things I like to point out is there's no doubt that towards the end of the 80s, the early 90s, the Soviet Union was having immense problems. Post-Afghanistan, not only military issues, but spending issues, budget, economic pressures. This really didn't have anything to do with NATO per se. I think NATO is often just thrown out there as if NATO somehow had been a real active player against the Russian Federation. Okay, maybe the Soviet Union, but not the Russian Federation. And as a matter of fact, NATO took every opportunity to stop spending money as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed. Anybody's thinking that their armaments budgets and their military spend budget didn't take a tailspin. This is referred to as essentially the peace bonus. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Soviet Union is collapsing. We don't have to spend all that money that we're spending. So if you just look at NATO, it's kind of like, no, that they were taking advantage of the situation in one way. Mm-hmm. However, in 1983, and I think 1983 is a real key date, okay, under the Reagan administration, Congress passed something called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was legislation that started funding for a number of agencies, and also both federal agency, but also supporting NGOs, non-government agencies, with monies that were intended to support conceptually the democratic process. You know, how do you hold free elections? How do you monitor free elections? Because as these blocks of former Soviet republics started dropping off on their own, the real hope was that they would become democratic and they wouldn't become dictatorships. They wouldn't become fiefdoms. And so that was a real thing. If you want to look at, you know, does any money start going into the pot that if I'm a dedicated Russian nationalist that I might object to, I probably would object to that rather than to NATO, because here's new money and new groups and new organizations who are sort of undermining my former spheres of influence, where I had a lot of influence politically. I mean, most everybody that was running those republics either were KGB officers or tightly bound to Soviet security in the KGB. So I kind of date 1983 as the starting point for when you might actually consider that there was a new pressure coming from the West towards the Soviet Union, or the Russian bloc, if you want to call it that. And of course, with the economic collapse of the Soviet Union, that was followed up by a lot of money, investment money, loans from the U.S., investment from Europe. It called that financial pressure. But if you want to look at pressure on the Russian sphere of influence, it was a pressure coming from these democracy initiatives, quote unquote, and from some financial initiatives. It wasn't coming from NATO. So it's like, I think you have to be honest saying, is there pressure? Was there pressure starting to be applied in the 80s and 90s against the Russian sphere of influence? You bet. It was not military pressure.
Yeah, and let me ask a question right here, because about that financial pressure. This is not exclusively the domain of U.S. interests, right? Mm. Because there were plenty of international concerns that got in that game, and you ended up with a variety of results from the former republics, right? The former Soviet republics. Clearly something happened different in Georgia than what happened in Chechnya. Something different happened in Ukraine than happened in Belarus, okay? These different areas ended up coming out differently one way or another. They made different deals. It seemed kind of organic, actually, not fully organized. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that.
It was totally organic, because a lot of it, you know, we always have this thing of follow the money, right? We always say that.
Right.
Well, a lot of the money, as you're talking about, was not coming. The money for the democratic initiatives were coming from the U.S., money for a lot of the, we actually made a lot of loans. The Clinton administration made a lot of loans and actually did a lot, which at the time the Russians loved, but later they considered it interference. And we gave them a lot of money. Right. We really did. However, the business money came from Europe, mm-hmm. from Germany, from France, from Italy, because they recognized these huge opportunities in Russia. I mean, if Russia is going to privatize, if Russia is going to, you know, redo its whole state-controlled economy, that's got to be an opportunity. Yeah, and as you said, it's organic. It depends on who knew who had good relations with whom, what was the money opportunity. And that's why, quite frankly, the net result of that was tying a lot of the countries so strongly in Europe to Russian gas.
Right.
You know, that was a huge investment opportunity. So, no, you're right on the money with that. In terms of the money, it was, a lot of it was, call it what you will. I mean, when the Soviet Union goes capitalist, who do you think is going to take advantage of that? The capitalist.
Well, there you go. And they exist in a lot of places. And that was why I purposely, I know it doesn't always sound like my language is purposeful, but believe it or not, I used the word opportunist twice in my lead up to you for a reason. There was a lot of opportunism here, because you had these now detached, nation states effectively they had different resources, right? You had, you know, people talk about Ukraine and how they, you know, they were this great wheat producer and all that. And again, remember, this is a place no bigger than the size of Texas, okay? Still, it had a resource to offer. So, obviously, somebody comes in and says, look, you don't have the centralized government to rely on any longer. We can make an investment with you if you have a nationalized resource. And they did this to varying degrees. And some of this was, you know, a bit predatory. Okay? I mean, to be mild about it, it was a little predatory.
More than a bit predatory. I mean, we're talking about capitalistic investment. I mean, that's the name of the game. Mm-hmm. That's not a negative. That's business, right?
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. But that's the point is, you know, you're going to, you know, buy low, sell high. Okay? I mean, it's pretty simple. You're going to come in there and give them the least amount that you can to prop something up, and now how are you going to pay me back? Well, maybe now I own this, or I own that, or I'm able to bring in... I mean, even when we saw the introduction of certain things that people saw as, you know, cultural Western elements, like it was very amusing for some years, the fast food chains, right? This is the first, you know... in Georgia, not Georgia, the state where I live, but Georgia, the country. Here's your first fast food chains in Georgia, right? Stuff like this. People, oh, look at that. They're actually, you know, Americanizing. They weren't Americanizing. That is a corporate interest stepping in to introduce their product to a brand new audience and introduce their whole system of franchise to a brand new market. I mean, am I right or wrong?
No, you're totally right, and it also gives a good opportunity to draw a distinction and answer a question you asked very early on, which is why Ukraine.
Right.
Okay. Now, Russia itself, the Russian state, offered a huge opportunity for retail investment, right, quite frankly, because they weren't set up to handle the kind of food businesses. I mean, so... they're a great opportunity to foreign companies to go in and establish their brands and do that sort of thing. So when most people think of the quote-unquote westernization of Russia, it has to do with those retail brands.
Right.
However, the interesting thing in terms of why Ukraine, you want to talk about where the smart money went? If you look at the history, Ukraine is thought of as being an agricultural state. But right. Ukraine was actually provided... if you want to look at where the designers, the engineers, the factories, the advanced technology hubs for the Soviet Union were, they were in Ukraine.
Right.
Ukraine had the space engineers, the aeronautical engineers. Ukraine built the largest aircraft in the world. Ukraine ran the shipyards that manufactured most of the Soviet Navy. Yeah, the smart money went into Ukraine, and you didn't see it, you know, because it's essentially capitalizing high-tech manufacturing and design businesses. And actually, one of the reasons that's really showing up now, because everybody is going, well, how in the world could the Ukrainians be so adaptable, take all these weapons, because that's what they already were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They knew good stuff, and that's I think something I think even Putin didn't fully understand is how much of the Soviet Union's brain trust, mm-hmm, and really technology resource came out of Ukraine.
See, now the people,
and it's still there.
Yeah, now the people that want to kind of be the Russophiles at this point, who are in support of the idea that, hey, you know. And I don't mean to get you bogged down in this. Just for a moment, we'll go to it, though. This whole idea that, you know, Putin is doing a righteous thing. He's, you know, freeing these Russians that were, you know, placed there or happened to just be there from oppression. You know, they're Nazis over there. They're all criminals. It's all kinds of organized crime in Ukraine and this and that. And therefore, it's justifiable what's going on, according to people that are sort of in support of Putin's moves here. I don't think that is accurate, first of all. But secondly, it certainly, even if that's part of the equation, does not tell the full story of what Ukraine represented. I mean, there was also the trade-off, and this is something that I think you need to address, is the trade-off with the weapons, right? Because there was they could have easily just turned around and become a nuclear state, Ukraine. And there was that whole negotiation that went on, right? Where they wrested control of their weapons over to others, didn't they? Because there were plenty of nukes there.
Total assurances. Yeah. I mean, Ukraine did what the international community asked them to do,
mm-hmm.
and Russia did. They were very compliant, if you will, mm-hmm. and maybe trusting at that point in time. But they literally would. They would have been the fourth superpower if they had wanted to play that role.
If they had enough atomic
weapons and enough missile sites, they could have set themselves up as a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
They decided they didn't want to play that kind of game, and the Russians have given them a whole series of assurances and violated each and every one of them. And nobody wants to talk about that, I think. But if you want to ask yourself, why in the world would Ukraine taking as much punishment mm-hmm. as they're taking now, why would they not settle for something? And the answer would be the last 30 years have shown them that they can't trust a single promise the Russians make.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of the situation. You're going to like it or you're not like it. The facts are clear. Russia signed any number of treaties and agreements which they violate at will. Just as they did when they assured the international community, hey, this is just an exercise with Belarus. Mm-hmm. We would never, ever, ever invade. Why would you expect the Ukrainians to believe anything or negotiate at all?
Well, I want to ask you to speculate about something here because, and this, maybe it's not a fair thing to ask you, but I mean, I am trying to wrap my mind around this. And you brought it up perfectly. The people that are very much kind of lobbying or advocating for when they're discussing this, whether it's, you know, among political brain trusts or it's in our media or it's in coverage of the action that is occurring, you know, is it a special military action? Is it an invasion? Blah, blah. It's funny to me because the people that are seeming to side with Zelensky and Ukraine don't want to bring up this whole thing about how the Russians have violated every assurance. They don't bring it up. You think they would. And obviously, the Russians, for their own interest, and the pro-Russian contingents also don't bring up the past arrangements. Where, you know what? This should not be happening, what's happening right now. As far as I can tell, this shouldn't have happened. And there are a bunch of things that have gone on in Ukraine. Like, they become a surrogate battlefield where a lot of other games were played, too. And eventually now we've gotten to this point of, no, I'm not really invading. Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't know how to even express it. It's so bizarre to me that, you know, that this is going on. Go ahead, yeah.
Let's give a characterization. I mean, what we really face to some extent is what had evolved by 2014,
mm-hmm.
okay, which becomes Putin made a statement yesterday that really all he's trying to do is end a war that started in 2014.
Yeah.
That's really a special operation. It's really to end a war in the Donbass that Ukraine started in 2014.
Right.
Against its own people or against the Russians in the Donbass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's give an equivalent. What really happened over a series of elections, beginning as early as 2008 on to 2014, you had a group of oligarchs in the eastern Ukraine who were Russian. I mean, these folks had always had close ties to Moscow. In other words, it was known that the government in Kiev was appointed by the government in Moscow through these people. That's just the way it was. And nobody can deny that. But that was their sphere of influence. That was the way it was going to be done. These oligarchs were out of the Donbass, and they were competing with the new wave, the technology. It was kind of like the old manufacturing agricultural sector competing with the more westernized, technology-driven, Eurocentric cultural. There was a conflict in Ukraine. It would be wrong to minimize that. But what happened then is the oligarchs in the East lost the election and seceded. Right. It's sort of like the South seceding from the Union in a way that they couldn't bring enough political leverage to play to hold their agenda, so they just literally seceded, and Russia intervened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Britain had intervened with the South to the extent that Russia intervened with the East in Ukraine, you might have had something. And what would you have called it? What would we have called it? You know, if you had a secession, the groups in the East literally broke off from the Ukrainian government and succeeded.
Right.
And as a union, Ukraine did essentially go to war to suppress that secession. So when Putin is saying, we're trying to resolve a war that started in 2014, what he's really saying is, we're trying to confirm the secession of East Ukraine.
Right.
If you translate it into that language and use the proper words, it's not like Kiev suddenly started to attack, you know, Russian speaking folks in eastern Ukraine before they seceded.
Right.
The war started after they seceded. So, but he does not mention the succession. He will picture it and position it as somehow Kiev and the fascist in Ukraine suddenly decided to start attacking our fellow, you know, Russian speaker. If you wanted to run this through a translation machine and put it into Polish, it would sound exactly like what Hitler said about Poland.
Right. Well, and then you got to put into context what happened with Crimea, right? Because see, now to me, the way that was reported across the board in all media appears to have been deceptively represented, and it appears to me as though there was, you know, clearly not an overwhelming majority of people in that place that really wanted to separate themselves from Ukraine, right? Although that's the way it was sort of sold to us at the time. What do you think about that?
Oh, it was certain, but I mean, I think the thing is, it wasn't done as a Crimean initiative. It wasn't like Crimea was just sitting there and suddenly said, okay, we're as Crimea, this Crimean province, oblast, whatever,
right.
Are going to conduct a vote to secede from Ukraine. No, it was, Russia took over through its naval base and through the insertion of the Wagner troops. They essentially took power in Ukraine and then managed an election. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there was a sane side to any of this and you wanted to make an argument that, you know, people were being oppressed and wanted to, you didn't see Putin or anyone else go to the UN and say, oh, these people are being oppressed. They're being victimized. We think the United Nations should hold a referendum.
Hmm.
We think the United Nations should enter. That didn't happen. I mean, if you really, because it wasn't real, you know, it was really a political power play. So there's no sign, and there are actually signs at the moment that there is a, now that the Russian military control of Crimea is not the totality that it was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if The last news item that I saw out of Crimea literally was from the Crimean quote-unquote government saying that their people should not be subject to military mobilization and recruitment by Russia. That, you know, that's not what they want. It's not what they agreed to. They didn't declare themselves a, you know, another Russian state. That's not the accord even that they expect. So, you know, a lot of this stuff just happens. And the same thing happened, quite frankly, earlier in Georgia when Russia attacked Georgia and literally overwhelmed them. You know, once you have military control, you can pretty much get any kind of election you want.
Of course,
we won't even go into when we've held elections in areas that we had military control over. You know, that's, again, you have to be objective. That's, if you hold the military power and your military is holding the election, you pretty much know how it's going to come out.
Yeah, right.
Regardless of what side you're on.
Well, right, because, you know, it is just that simple. So, but that's the thing, this is why I don't necessarily understand the support from people who, you know, say that they are against the concept of, you know, imperial powers stepping in and getting involved with smaller nation states and, you know, chopping off pieces of them, you know, acquiring them, annexing them, or annexing pieces of these smaller nations. I mean, a lot of people that I've known over the years are commentators on this, and they seem to have always objected to that sort of behavior, and yet this is justifiable. And I say, well, look, if you examine this objectively, and maybe I don't fully understand Russian politics, I grant you that, but how do you view this any other way, and is this not, I mean, let me just put the question to you bluntly. The situation in Crimea almost seems like, well, let's just try that again over here in another section of what this place is. I mean, or am I wrong?
It's exactly the same. It's just that this time Ukraine was aware of what was happening to it and prepared a bit and pushed back. I mean, they were taken – I mean – Russia had given them such assurances that they would never do what they did in Crimea that they didn't believe it was going to happen. They really, truly didn't believe it was going to happen. I mean, up until the day it happened, again, Putin was going through his whole thing. You know, we're not going to take over Crimea. We're not going to annex Crimea. I can show, I quote his sentences in Creating Chaos.
Right.
Literally saying under no circumstances would we ever make Crimea part of the Russian Federation? I mean, said that. And then when he says, does the opposite, it's like, well, oh yeah, I said that, but now, you know, it doesn't count. The difference is that I think Ukraine to this time around didn't trust the Russians and was prepared to push back at least to some extent, even though it was a shock. I think that's the difference, but I am stunned to some extent that all of those people that are happy to talk about, and I'm one of them, having written about it extensively, American sins and American imperialism and the sins of the CIA, you know, it's like, well, we did so much of that, then it's, we feel so bad we're not going to criticize it when Russia does it. You know, it's like, we were imperialist and we were bad, but so it's now their turn? That just makes no sense at all. And certainly the European nations know better than that. I'm actually encouraged to the extent of which the great body of European nations from Sweden now to Latvia are standing up and saying, we can't exist in a world with Russia doing what Russia is doing. We've got to stop that.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, is like, I don't like to side on the, you know, in the general mainstream terms, right, usually I'm very, very skeptical of the people that are in American corporate media who say, look, this is a good thing. Or, you know, you need to support these people, this place. I'm always skeptical about what their foundational beliefs are that lead them to say this. You know, I don't see the American media in general, the mainstream, the corporate, supporting the idea of anybody's independence anywhere, usually, you know. So I feel it almost as a positive signal that we see that happening, for the most part, in our media. And yet we have our own politicians divided on this. I mean, I know some people hold out different hopes because, you know, the GOP is going to be, and is at the moment, taking power, and they're taking actions and changing the direction of many of where the energies are going to go regarding this. I've also seen the disappearance of the debate, which I'm wondering if you wanted to address, regarding exactly what the assistance level is going to be from the United States during this situation, which, again, the only thing that I am in disbelief of is not that Putin did this, or not that they wanted to fight back in Ukraine, but the fact that they've held out this long, and that, you know, because we just saw, what, a couple of weeks ago, supposedly the general in charge changed, you know, regarding this action in Ukraine, and people speculated briefly as to whether there would be, you know, nuclear weapons might now be in play as far as the strategic concern is. And I'm saying to myself, you know, how far is this going to go? How long can this last? I'm in disbelief that it's taken this long, that there hasn't been, I don't know, more intense actions taken by neighboring states, by the Europeans, by the United States. I mean, I understand you can't, you know, they're not a NATO nation, they're not part of the treaty, and all that. I get all that. But at some point, it just seems to me like there's going to come a time when, either inadvertently or directly, this will impact some of these nations which are under the protection of that agreement. The United States, as per that charter, I mean, you know, the very, very oversimplified version of it is, any NATO state that's attacked, I mean, when we were attacked on 9/11, for instance, and I'm not getting into the controversy of it, we were attacked on 9/11. I mean, you got to agree to that. I'm saying that when that happened, technically speaking, NATO nations were supposed to respond as if they were attacked. This is part of the main charter, right? I mean, or am I misunderstanding this?
No. And to a large extent, actually, they did. Mm-hmm. It's just their involvement was more on the intelligence, basically, since the war on terror, other than the military war, which we largely conduct ourselves, the covert side, right. The intelligence work, the covert action, the identification of the cells, you would not find more cooperation than you know, from Britain was a huge, cooperated immensely in that work, so did France, you know, especially the larger nations with intelligence services just jumped right in to start sharing intelligence. Right. But yeah, that's the way that's supposed to work. I think one of the things that confuses me, and I think I'm trying to get past it, is in terms of the political parties.
Right.
I mean, as old as I am, it's hard for me to realize a lot of the language that's coming out of the Republican Party, which it's not the language I grew up with. That's right. You know, like we have to be involved and engaged overseas. We have to, you know, we're here to defend the democratic process. It's part of defending ourselves. We learned that in World War II. Okay, let's face it. The post World War II was a lesson in that we can't pull back from the world. I mean, America had been isolated to the extent that World War II happened. Mm-hmm. You know, we just, We didn't rearm. We didn't do all these other things. World War II happened. We became part of an international alliance and just accepted the fact that we were engaged as a world power. And we couldn't ignore the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that really had nothing to do with parties. It's a higher level that we became overcame the isolationism.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of gotten to the point where I don't think about parties anymore. I think about where given politicians are either isolationist, call it America first. That's like, we don't care about the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're isolated to the extent where it doesn't matter. We don't have to be engaged. We don't have to spend money. Their concerns are not their concerns. So I no longer map it to political parties. I relate it to isolationism.
Well, and that's
just like,
yeah, and that's a constantly re-emerging debate, right? About exactly what level of involvement the American military, being that it is the most well-equipped and the most well-funded military force on the planet, what level to which are we supposed to be involved, right? Because isolationism in its purest form leads us to problems like World War II. However, too much interventionism creates entire regions that wind up, you know, with a grudge, let's just call it. I mean, I know I'm boiling this down to some very basic terms, but...
No, but you're totally right. It's where do you set the dial?
Well,
you
right.
can see in either direction.
And the weird thing is that, yeah. that it's just that in the corridors of power, the people that make these decisions, the people that are supposed to declare war, the people that set the policies, we see a clear political aspect to this that I think has not been this extreme. I mean, maybe my read of history is not so good, okay? Maybe I'm willing to accept that, but I don't recall there being such a need to resist the opposition that the dial gets set so far in two different directions just based on the fact that they are the opposition, right? What do I mean by this? It seems to me as though Republicans have gone from that older language, that older orientation that you talked about, where they literally did want to be, now I'm going to throw out one of those old Cold War phrases, they wanted the American military to be the world's policeman, right? And go around and intervene anywhere where we can encourage democracy, intervene anywhere where, quite honestly, we could encourage all those brands and business interests you and I were talking about, to spread, right? Spread Americana, spread democracy, spread freedom, with a barrel of a gun, but do it, right? This was the thing. We'll sign off on that. We'll support, you know, the people in South America. Of course, that's a minefield of all sorts of things. We'll support the people that are supposed to be on our side everywhere we can, whether it's with money or it's with, you know, economic support that is not necessarily in monetary form, but is in goods and services, right? Or if it's directly with political idealism, interventionism, education, let's bring more of them over here to be educated so we send them back with more American ideals. All these different things, that seemed to me to be the business of one side of the equation, always. The other side of the equation would say, no, we need to be forgiving of all of these other people. We don't understand them, and we shouldn't be involved so much because self-determination is most important. We don't need to enforce our way of life, our way of thinking upon others, etc. And that seemed to be the two orientations. The severity and the strange split, and I'm wondering what this means for the future as far as, are we going to continue this program of throwing money at the problem, which is all I see us doing now, right, is encouraging, well, no, let's see if we can encourage some weapons to get transferred over, but no boots on the ground. Okay, we're going to send some money. Okay, we need to send some more money. So they've earmarked and sent lots of money to Ukraine, okay, and supported them rhetorically on the world stage. Not only are we in support of the leader of Ukraine, we're letting him address Congress, right? We're bringing him here in person to address Congress. He leaves his country while it's in war to come and talk to a joint session of Congress. We're bringing him via Zoom to anything we can, whether it's an award show or it's the UN. We're facilitating this. right? On the one hand. But on the other hand, is the political divisiveness, is this going to become one of those things where, as one side or the other of the equation, we now need to be opposition to this simply because our opponents politically are so pro-support of Ukraine, etc. I wonder if you want to unpack that at all. But I think it's an important thing because we're going to see this change coming this year.
The best way to unpack it is to... Okay. If you go back a bit, if you divide it into territorial versus political, I mean, when North Korea invaded South Korea, there was no argument. Mm-hmm. I mean, we put boots on the ground. It was, you know, we have to preserve the territories. If we don't preserve the territories, it will lead to larger scale conflicts.
Or domino effect. Or domino effect where, okay.
Hey, look at Kuwait. Same thing. Nobody questioned that at all except the Russians, of course. I mean, when, when somebody gets invaded, we have always traditionally put boots on the ground because it could escalate. Mm-hmm. We didn't this time.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting. And you can get into, we had no legal obligation to defend South Korea, nor Kuwait. You know, we didn't, you know, you can say, oh, well, somebody was a member of an alliance. Okay, fine. Forget the legalities. But we have now entered a stage where, and I think it probably has to do with the fact that we're a little bit conflicted because we would like to be more isolationist, right? I think there is a general mood towards that. And we don't, you know, we've been disappointed by globalism and it sins, so we'd like to be more isolationist.
Well, look,
but we also realize that atomic weapons and hypersonic weapons and space, I mean, in reality, on the military side of the equation, you can't be isolationist.
Well, right, and understand.
When somebody can launch a K-12 cruise missile over the Sea of Azov inside Russia to take out the electric infrastructure in Kiev, there is no there. Speed and time and space. You can't build walls against that.
Well, no, we're now in an age again, and we have been for some time. It's not brand new. Where these, you know, these protections of distance are not the same as they once were at all. You know, the idea that, oh, well, America's way over here, so if there's a struggle way over here, it's never going to come to our shores. Now it hasn't. In a couple hundred years. But honestly, it could very easily. The potential is there. I'm trying to take this apart objectively with you. I mean, my viewpoint, my personal feeling is, yeah, I'd like to see a lot more isolationism from the United States in general, because I feel as though we got too many homegrown problems to deal with, okay, to be investing billions of dollars into everybody else's problems, okay? Frankly, I do feel that way. Personally, it doesn't mean that objectively I don't see that there is a need to do other things. It doesn't mean that I'm not willing to examine that other side of the equation. But generally speaking, I mean, if you put me in charge, Larry, I mean, yeah, I would be supporting Ukraine because, to me, it's a fight for independence, and you have to allow that we will support people fighting for their own independence. I think that'll make for a good ally for us down the road. If we supported a successful fight for somebody's independence somewhere, I look at it that way, pragmatically, right? But do we need to be involved in all these
things? What we didn't talk about, Chuck, we didn't have time to talk about yet, is...
Go ahead.
It's Russian active measures.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cold War, really. We've kind of... Ukraine kind of sucks you into this because that's where we are now. But I think all of those people that are talking about just Ukraine in regard to Putin, you talked about what people don't bring up.
Right.
They don't bring up the Russian invasion of Belarus.
Right.
Invasion. The Russian takeover of Belarus, if you want, you know, it was a quiet takeover because they did it with money and
Right.
And they put enough Russian troops in for joint exercises, so it's like, okay. The same thing goes for Georgia.
Well, right, but that was...
We didn't really talk about the reinvigoration, and I would say at some point we should, that what really occurred was in 1992 when Russia... I opened up by talking about the Reagan Democracy Initiative. Where we went to Ukraine, we really didn't go to the fact of Russia countered by restarting active measures against the West in 1992 right. with the renaming and reinvigoration and retargeting of the KGB and the Russian military and intelligence. And we can now show that across Europe, mm-hmm. across Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and ultimately in the United States, they restarted the Cold War. They really did.
Yes. If you'll do it, Larry, I want you to put a bookmark in this section of our talk here so we can do a part two. We can do it in 2 weeks or we can do it next week. We'll figure that out when we're done on air here, okay? But I want to continue this discussion because we did indeed get bogged down in Ukraine. But I think it was necessary because this illustrates not only, you know, the historical pattern that we can make out of the circumstance, okay, but it also gives us a tool for prognostication. I hate to say that, but it's the truth. What will be the future is another part of this discussion, right? Not only what has been done with propaganda and the various spheres of influence so far, but what does it potentially set up to almost be a certainty in the near future? I think that's another part of this discussion as well. So, before we're done, I'd like to try to conclude the discussion about Ukraine, although I have a feeling we'll still have to revisit it next time we get together. Okay? But try to conclude it a bit, because to me, this is something that has not been discussed objectively anywhere. Okay, and I'm trying to discuss this as, I say this for the listeners, not for you, Larry. I'm trying to go through this as objectively as possible. What can we learn? What does this actually mean for us, you know, in the Western world, in the U.S.? What does it really mean? Because a lot of people that are against this, and I still want to stick you with the political question. Because the change in the guard there in the House of Representatives does mean that there will be a change in priorities. We already know this because, guess what? We now have a special counsel already for Biden and his documents real fast, okay? So we know that there is going to be a shift in priority. Our friend Larry Schnapp is really hoping against hope that in order to make the Biden administration look bad, that the new Republicans coming in and having majority in the House will bode well for oversight with the Assassination Records Review Board. I know that's a totally other issue, but point is, people are going to now look to what is going to change regarding, guess what, the people that actually get to effectively endorse the checks for where it is we're spending our money, right? The people that, you know, that branch of the government that really legally is the one that should be declaring war or not, okay? That branch of the government that will actually draft the paperwork that's going to eventually mean we're funding somebody, we're not funding somebody, okay? All of that, those things might indeed change a bit as far as the priorities go, as far as the amount of money being spent. There is a serious political question there. So I want to ask you about that and if that really matters, or are we looking at something that is, again, at a higher level that's going to be continued to be supported, and I'm asking you to predict something as opposed to telling me about history. And I know that's not your wheelhouse, Larry. You are a historian. So, you know, you're great with history. I'm not saying anything about your psychic abilities. You may indeed be psychic, Larry. I don't know. It's possible. I mean, you know, and I also know from tonight that you have a kitty cat nearby. You know.
Yes, I do.
So, you know, just that's the first time I think I've ever heard Larry's cat on the air. But
it's because it's winter and the cat just really thinks the laptop is a great source of heat.
No, I know. I got a puppy that thinks I constantly have food, and believe it or not, I've been able to keep Buster off air so far, but You'll hear from him one of these days. But look, how would we conclude this for part one? Because obviously we're going to have to go into more of it next time, discuss the transition, if you will, because we didn't even get into really your wheelhouse, which is the transition of the posture, behavior, and reorganization that took place regarding the, the KGB to FSB, right? We didn't get into that at all. We, touched upon many different political spheres of influence, the stuff that's on the surface, the propaganda, communication sphere of influence. We did touch upon that a bit, but that is barely scratching the surface regarding the rebooting, the reheating, the reemergence, the maybe continuation of the Cold War posture and what that really means as we go forward on the global stage. So, with all that, I'm going to shut up now and give it to you.
I'll make a prediction then. The prediction that I'm going to make, it's kind of interesting, is we're going to learn that we're not as important as we think.
Ooh.
And U.S. politics isn't as... It was very important for the U.S. to engage with money and weapons. This first 12 months were very important. I mean, if we had not done that, Europe would not have come together. We played a huge role. If this had happened under the Trump administration, Ukraine would belong to Russia this afternoon. That's a statement, okay? Right. That's another kind of prediction. However, NATO was reformed just in time, not just NATO. I shouldn't even say just NATO. The European community was reinvigorated. It was in a couple of years, enough trust was established, enough networking was done to enable the Europeans to work with each other and with us, and to present something of a united front, which they are doing.
Okay,
and
pause for a second, because I want to interject something here, and then I'm going to let you close it out, okay? And you guys need to go to larry-hancock.com, follow Larry's blog. Obviously, I recommend all of his books. His author page will be included in the show notes, guaranteed. Go there and check out Larry's blog and his website, Larry Hancock. If you don't know how to spell it, please figure it out, or Google will fill it in for you, okay? Point is, I recommend all of his writing, but... Last thing here to interject is that I actually have a potential upcoming guest who, with a very serious face, you just brought up the whole, it would belong to Russia today. It would have belonged to Russia 6 months ago, I think, easily.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
If Trump was in there. But I have a guest who is an intelligent man who is also an author. I'm not going to reveal his name to anybody because he's a new guest and I might bring him on. although he's a little disagreeable with me for one reason. About this topic, he believes that without Trump having pressured, NATO and all that, that Ukraine would have, like, in other words, exactly the opposite of what you just said. That the only reason why Ukraine has been able to stand up this long is because Trump made sure that, the other NATO nations kicked in more of their money like they were supposed to. Remember that whole thing about they're not paying their fair share? And he was saying, maybe NATO has outlived its usefulness. His argument is literally that Trump actually did the work ahead of time to make it so that Ukraine would be already handed over if it had just been, Biden administration policy without Trump setting that table. So I'm just telling you that there is a school of thought out there. I don't know how wide it is that that's the case. And I find that untenable, but... Maybe it's just me and my prejudices, Larry.
And
I'll let you close this out.
The good news is actually you could resolve that factually.
Okay.
One of the things that helps resolve it is what are the weapon systems that are being given to Ukraine? And I think if you will look at those weapon systems, the ammunition, and you look at when it was purchased, that would tell you a lot, because I think what you will find is what's being given to Ukraine was bought out of budgets years and years ago before Trump. I mean, including the Leopard tank. A lot of what is going from the European nation is stuff that they purchased 10 to 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that has nothing to do with Trump. What they're doing now is they plan to, they've committed, and I would agree with them, Trump worried them. Here's my agreement would be, Trump worried them to the extent that they thought that they could no longer count on the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
So they started planning for new purchases. They did start increasing their budgets. Germany's the outlier to that, lag behind everybody else. But he did it in a negative fashion. Mm-hmm. Not so much what he made them do is they lost trust.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, especially the smaller nations said, oh Lord, we can no longer count on the Americans. We've got to have a new plan. And that did create, you know, that created a world where we are. They started placing new orders, and they're going to be backfilling all the old stuff that they're donating with new purchases out of increased budgets. That is true. So I would not argue against the fact that what he did led to this. But I would say it was more in a negative manner than a positive manner, as far as they're concerned.
Right.
But the other part of my prediction is, I think we were very important over the last 12 months,
mm-hmm.
but over the coming months, when you look at what's going to Ukraine to help them,
right.
The main battle tanks are going to be coming from Poland and Sweden, and you know, we're not the key player there. We don't even have the right equipment there because we spent the last three decades reconfiguring ourselves to fight a different kind of war and not fight the kind of war that you fought in Europe with battle tanks.
Right.
We don't have those systems. They still do. They're their old systems. And I think you're going to see that we actually had to do less. We have to do training. We have to do some things. So I don't think Europe is going to take a much stronger role than the U.S. because it needs to, it has to, and they've already done it. I mean, quite frankly, the other part of that prediction is they've already bitten the bullet on energy. Europe could have caved to Russia sometime in the last 12 months. Because they didn't, and because they ran a real risk with this winter, they're going to be largely energy independent. And that is the biggest loss that Russia will suffer and could possibly have suffered. Russia already lost.
Right.
Putin already lost. Anything that he could gain in the Donbass will never offset what Russia and the Russian Federation has lost. Never.
Well, then in that case, I know I said I only have one more question. I actually have one last one, and we are about over a couple of minutes, but I have to ask this of you. Because it's gonna come up. I know it's gonna, with a discussion with somebody who thinks like this, and he's partially right in my mind, like you said, but I can't support the idea that this was some master stroke that was done intentionally. But anyway, back to it. The last thing is this. Is it possible though, cause like you said, in a practical sense, yeah, Poland's gonna supply stuff and this and that. Are they not doing this on behalf of the U.S., and is this not going to be something that ultimately is going to benefit? Like, we're not going to directly sell weapons to Ukraine necessarily, but maybe we give them money, they'll sell it to our allies, and our allies will turn around and reorder newer stuff from us anyway. Like, is this, you know...
And I can't argue against that, but I will tell you, what Poland is re-equipping itself with
mm-hmm.
are not U.S. Abrams, but South Korean K-10s, nice. Main battle tanks. South Korea is going to be a major winner in the arms business. They're going to be a major winner in the chip supply business,
right.
As will Taiwan. So is somebody going to profit from this? You bet. I'm not sure that if you look at the weapon systems, that the losers in terms of the military industrial complex,
mm-hmm.
the losers are probably going to be Germany and mm-hmm. Switzerland in terms of a lot of funding and they've been doing. The winners not necessarily going to be the U.S. manufacturers, quite frankly, because right at the moment we're hard stressed to manufacture enough ammunition, rockets, missiles, smart devices, even to backfill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say the war itself obviously is a great benefit to all military manufacturers. It would be foolish not to say that.
Right.
You know,
of course.
And did they start it so that they could generate business? I'm not going to go there, but I don't think it won't strictly, because the U.S. is not the sole power in military weaponry that it once was.
Mm-hmm.
There are alternatives,
right.
And
right.
Especially for the kind of weapons that Europe needs, you know, that Poland needs, that probably the biggest winners are going to be the people that prove that they can rush out artillery and anti-aircraft. It's fascinating for me to see the gigantic demand for anti-aircraft weaponry because of the drones.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't have it. I mean, we ourselves do not. We have our own crash programs to deal with drones. Nobody has the answer to that, except rolling out a lot of World War II anti-aircraft weapons.
Right, which is, again, anyway, we're definitely going to be the winners, because there's going to be a part two to this discussion with author Larry Hancock regarding the new Cold War, if you will. What that actually means, how that translates, and of course we hovered quite a bit on Ukraine here during this hour, but absolutely necessary. Larry, thank you, and I look forward to continuing this with you in the very near future.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chuck.
Excellent. And meanwhile, guys, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember this. I am Emilio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect, and quite frankly, also keep in mind that your support is absolutely necessary to keep us going. I'm going to stress that over the next couple of weeks, and anybody who wants to buy me a coffee today, I would really appreciate it. Anyhow, leave it at that. Thanks to Mike Swanson for being on the first hour, and thank you guys for being part of the effect. Good night.